you can face up to 10 years in prison and a $250,000 fine simply for leasing to a cannabis business, even if you don't know, even if you're not involved in the operation. So that's important to remember.
Welcome back to Future Proof. I am your host, Bill Sheridan. Pleased to meet you. How the heck are you, by the way? Hope you're feeling great. Hope that pain you've been having is going away and that thing you've been dealing with is working itself out. And, you know, that life is just generally good. Me, I feel pretty good. It's like Joe Walsh says, I can't complain, but sometimes I still do. You know, it's kind of like that. And hey, if you aren't feeling great, I've got a little something for you this week that might help. How about a little pot, a little weed, grass, Mary Jane, ganja, marijuana, cannabis. We've got some of that for you this week, or at least a little cannabis conversation. Anyway, it's high time we talked about this stuff. With emphasis on high, yes, pun most definitely intended. Seriously though, folks, if we want to be future proof, if we really want to future proof this profession, we need to expand this conversation about the cannabis business, or cannabis, as some people are calling it. This wave of legalization for both medical and recreational cannabis products, as it's growing. At the state level, seems at this point like it's a hard trend, a future fact. And of course, with cannabis still illegal at the federal level, there are lots of landmines to step around from a business and legal and financial point of view. These businesses need our help more than ever, and we need help too. There are just a lot of complexities here. And here this week to help us come to a joint understanding, if you will. Hey, folks, I can do this all day. About how we can best serve our clients in this area is Emily Burns. Emily is an attorney and founder of Legally Burns LLC, which provides customized legal and consulting services specifically for the rapidly evolving cannabis industry. She personally is an expert on cannabis-related legal, regulatory, and policy issues. She's worked with a wide variety, wide range of individuals and entities in the public and private sector over the past 4 years, including financial institutions, federal policymakers, state regulatory agencies, and licensed businesses in Oregon and Maryland and across the Mid-Atlantic. And she also provides guidance to legal, accounting, and financial professionals who are working with cannabis industry clients. So in other words, she is exactly who I want to talk to about this stuff. And I will, and I do. We'll get to that conversation here in just a couple of minutes. First, let me tell you that this week's show is sponsored by the Business Learning Institute, the BLI, which delivers competency-based curriculum, courses, content, and community to maximize career trajectories and grow intellectual capital for organizational and executive leadership. Hundreds of courses by dozens of instructors and unlimited customization. Find out how the Business Learning Institute can help you by visiting blionline.org. Now, here's what caught my eye this week. It's an article in one of the Washington Post's daily newsletters. Came out last week, called Cannabis Goes Culinary, about what might become a growing trend in states where recreational marijuana is legal. We're talking about high-end cannabis restaurants. And here's what Washington Post reporter Maura Judkis writes. She says, quote, like any good chef about to open a restaurant, Andrea Drummer wants to get her pairings just right. But her lamb chops with plantain mango salsa won't be matched with wine or beer. Instead, a bud tender, some in the industry call them ganjiers, as in ganja sommeliers, will help guests at the soon-to-open Lowell Farms Cannabis Cafe pair their farm-to-table meal with the perfect strain of farm-to-table marijuana. When the rustic plant-filled 220-seat space opens, it will be the first of its kind in America, a place for locals and tourists to have a high-quality meal and smoke a joint in public. Other restaurants are soon to follow, but if they want weed on the menu, restaurateurs in the famously progressive city, which in 2017 approved an ordinance allowing business licenses for this purpose, will still have to navigate a complicated patchwork of regulations. States that have legalized recreational cannabis will be watching how the city pulls it off. Colorado Governor Jared Polis signed a bill in May allowing cannabis lounges. And if legalization continues apace, cannabis restaurants might eventually become as normal as wine bars, said Sean Black, co-founder of Lowell Herb Company. The cannabis company opening the cafe, that's Lowell Herb Company. Sean Black says, whatever West Hollywood does now, the rest of the blue states at least do 3 years later. So, end quote there. And that's the kind of momentum that this legalization push is creating, right? Brand new businesses that have to navigate legal minefields that didn't exist a decade ago, you know? Jackie Subek, who is chairwoman of the Cannabis Legislative Subcommittee for the West Hollywood Chamber of Commerce, she told the Post, quote, with cannabis, we are building the boat as we are on the water. End quote. And that's why the trusted advice of a CPA is more important than ever. And that's why CPAs need to get familiar with the legal and financial issues facing businesses like these. And there are a ton of those types of issues, folks. And that's why I was really excited to sit down with Emily Burns this week. She knows this stuff as well or better than most people I know. And she's got a lot of really solid advice for anyone who's looking to better serve clients in the cannabis industry. So really interesting stuff here this week, folks. Here is Emily Burns. So Emily, thanks for joining me today. Let's start with a quick review, if you can, of where we stand with regard to legal cannabis. I mean, how many states at this point have legalized, I guess, first of all, recreational cannabis?
I think it's 9 states plus DC at this point. So we have actually 49 states have passed laws relating to the possession, manufacture, and distribution of cannabis or cannabis-derived products like cannabidiol or CBD, as it's commonly known.
Okay, so 49, and 9 of them have legalized recreational. I guess the rest is related to medical use. Is that accurate?
Yes. Medical use, and then there's also more limited medical use in the form of cannabidiol or CBD. And in these states, oftentimes it is not legal to actually manufacture and distribute CBD, but the possession of CBD under a certain amount is decriminalized, meaning there are no criminal sanctions for possession of that product.
And that's kind of where we are here in Maryland, correct?
Actually, Maryland has a pretty expansive medical cannabis program as of today. So we've been, I guess, operating a medical cannabis industry for almost 2 years. It will be 2 years in December since distributors in Maryland have begun actually, you know, growing product and distributing it to patients in Maryland. So I know that they're considering recreational at this point, but Maryland has a very loose definition of medical necessity in comparison to many states.
Okay. I don't know, just kind of in general, would you say that the momentum for legalization throughout the country is continuing to grow?
It's really incredible to see the change that has happened across the country. Over the past 4 years, having worked in this industry, I think a lot of it has to do with opioid crisis because of new studies coming out demonstrating the potential to supplement opioid painkillers with medical cannabis products, as well as if many people have seen Sanjay Gupta's film on the benefits of cannabidiol for treating grand mal seizures in individuals with Dravet syndrome. So once people have figured out that CBD is non-psychoactive and it's still derived from marijuana, and that there are, you know, in states where it has been legalized, there haven't been many problems. That has really created a remarkable, I guess, sea change across the country that I've seen firsthand, which is kind of cool.
So yeah, and I guess along those same lines, what do you think would be the tipping point where, I don't know, nationwide legalization would have to be considered at some point? What happened there?
So actually, there was a major development yesterday because the Department of Justice, as the Drug Enforcement Administration, which is within the DOJ, announced that it would be issuing rules for purposes of evaluating and granting additional applications so that more research institutions could grow marijuana and we could really figure out, you know, what strains can treat various conditions. Because for over 50 years, the University of Mississippi has had a monopoly on the growing of research-grade marijuana under federal law. So even though in 2016, the Department of Justice had announced it would begin accepting new applications for researchers, they never actually really did anything to move along these applications. So yesterday's announcement is significant because the DEA essentially works with the Food and Drug Administration in order to determine whether a drug, including cannabis, should be rescheduled or placed in a lower schedule or just removed from the Controlled Substances Act. And what we've needed for years is essentially the facilitation of research in order to, you know, convince and persuade the FDA officials that this is not something that should remain in Schedule 1, which is the most restrictive category for controlled substances.
So that announcement, that development, in essence, would promote that type of research? Is that what I'm hearing?
Yes, it would promote research at the federal level and allow different institutions and clinical studies to look into various strains and figure out how the different cannabinoids, terpenes, flavonoids present within the plant can actually interact with our endocannabinoid receptors. And this is significant because it does not require any political process and it completely avoids any politics whatsoever, which is obviously a good thing in today's day and age. Because nothing, you know, really that has been something that's held up the industry and legalization for a long time is, you know, politicians at the federal level, you know, can agree, okay, some type of legalization is necessary, but really the nuance and complexity is lost among politicians within that debate. So really this is important because it allows us to bypass, you know, any sort of, I guess, rhetoric and hyperbole that's often the subject of federal policy debates.
Very nice. A bit of a relief there. In the meantime, So in the meantime, though, there are some considerable issues that accountants have to grapple with when it comes to, you know, accounting for legal cannabis. What are some of the biggest issues that we need to be aware of?
So number one is 280E, IRS section 280E. This prohibits the deduction of business and operating expenses for cannabis businesses because 280E, essentially the way it's written, prevents business and or ordinary business expenses from being deducted for purposes of anyone who is trafficking in a Schedule 1 or Schedule 2 controlled substance. So this is from the Al Capone era. And this is something that obviously is very hard on cannabis businesses because, you know, you're looking at a very, very high income tax rate. And that brings us to the probably second most significant issue, which relates to the deductions for cost of goods sold for purposes of determining gross taxable income. because oftentimes people or accountants and financial advisors have been very generous with how they're allocating various the cost of goods sold. And the IRS tax court has made very clear that they are going to look at any tax deductions with strict scrutiny. So there was a case out of California, the Champs case, which considered whether a caregiving organization that also provided marijuana to patients fell within the purview of Section 280E, or whether they could essentially distinguish between both businesses and then only have 280E apply to the marijuana side of the business. And so a lot of people have taken that to mean that if you run a marijuana company or cannabis business and you also sell t-shirts or, you know, paraphernalia, that, you know, you can essentially make that distinction, which the IRS tax court has reaffirmed again and again is not the case. And it's a very rare circumstance when that would apply. And so that's, you know, probably the two most significant issues among many others, as you can imagine.
Yeah. So, I mean, what kind of advice do you typically offer for, you know, accountants and businesses alike when trying to navigate that type of, you know, field of landmines when it comes to the, you know, federal law versus laws where it's legal? But how do we deal with all that?
So I am very conservative, and I encourage other people to be very conservative with regards to how they're advising clients, because at the end of the day, the IRS is quick to scrutinize cannabis tax returns. And we're also seeing at the federal level the Department of Justice's antitrust division is now investigating or requesting information from, I guess, three cannabis companies that are in the process of a merger. And when you think about the potential implications legally and ethically with regards to making sure accounting and financials are, you know, completely in order, it's, you know, I can't even emphasize enough how important it is to, you know, be sort of the bad cop, if you will, mm-hmm. and explain that, you know, regardless of how much, you know, how difficult it is to operate in a cash business and, you know, pay this high tax rate, it's simply the price of doing business in this industry, which is something that, you know, I know that there's a lot of talk behind, you know, closed doors about ways to finagle the financials. And right. That's something that I, you know, really, really discourage, obviously, because oftentimes it's either ignorance or it's simply, you know, trying to do what's, you know, I guess going to make the client happy. Mm-hmm. And so that's something that you really need to consider is it's not worth it in the right. end, right? So, you know, that's my definitely the most important thing with respect to advising clients on these issues.
Yeah. So in other words, the law is the law, and you got to stay within those parameters, right?
Right. Exactly.
Are there, and this is just me not knowing what I don't know here, but are there differences in these types of issues between, you know, recreational and medical cannabis? Any differences in the ways that those two things are treated from either a legal or financial standpoint?
So yes, as far as a legal perspective, since 2014, the Congress has included a budget rider that essentially prohibits funding the Department of Justice for purposes of enforcing federal marijuana laws with respect to medical cannabis states, which does not include, obviously, the recreational states. Mm-hmm. So this is it has to be renewed every year. And it essentially it was challenged actually in 2014. And the Ninth Circuit held that basically if you are in compliance with the medical cannabis laws of your respective state, then the Department of Justice cannot use federal funds to come in and enforce federal law as long as, you know, you are in compliance. So that's, you know, obviously compliance is key. However, now that we have many recreational states coming on board, this has confused, you know, obviously many people because that provision does not cover recreational cannabis programs. Mm-hmm. So, you know, that makes it difficult. However, many states have essentially made it almost impossible to distinguish between the medical and recreational programs. So, you know, basically regulating and overseeing both industries from the same agency and allowing, you know, dispensaries essentially to disperse products to both medical and recreational consumers. And part of that, you know, rationale is if the Department of Justice did come in to, you know, to enforce the federal law and with respect to a recreational cannabis program, it would almost be, it wouldn't be worth their while. And it just simply is a way to sort of deter federal law enforcement efforts with respect to the recreational programs. So it's a bit complicated, obviously, but states have tried to really, you know, prevent, I guess, the threat of a federal crackdown.
Yep. Yep.
So getting back to advice for clients, now you offered some really good advice on the legal front. What other types of advice should we be giving our cannabis clients? What do they typically struggle the most?
So probably with respect to finding a property is one thing, especially when you're looking at the Controlled Substances Act, something I do think is important. People don't realize that there are numerous provisions under the Controlled Substances Act that apply to third parties. So even though, you know, if you're a landlord, for example, you can face up to 10 years in prison and a $250,000 fine simply for leasing to a cannabis business, even if you don't know, even if you're not involved in the operation. So that's important to remember with respect to civil asset forfeiture. So people oftentimes think, you know, about the criminal, right? Criminal convictions, the criminal law enforcement. However, when you are talking about civil asset forfeiture, you do not need a criminal conviction to actually seize property and business assets for purposes of law enforcement. So if you are a property owner and, you know, you have a lien or a mortgage on the property and you have title insurance, obviously, then, you know, if you're leasing to a cannabis business, it's not only about criminal enforcement, but also, you know, the risk that the property will be seized in a civil forfeiture action. And I guess another thing that I've seen come up a lot is these, you know, cross-border security transactions. So right now we have a number of cannabis businesses listed on the Canadian and United States Securities Exchange. And it's essentially as these companies grow and expand and become subject to a number of due diligence and financial disclosures that they otherwise would not be, we are seeing quite a bit of, I guess, malfeasance in the industry at this point in time. And we've had quite a number of scandals in the past few months with respect to financial disclosures and also accounting practices. So I think it's also important to emphasize that this industry needs to grow up. So if you're serving this industry, you cannot expect that people will, you know, treat you kindly or give you the benefit of the doubt. That's simply, you know, wishful thinking. So especially as, you know, the laws change and we obviously advance as an industry, these companies need to sort of get their ducks in a row. And that's why I always emphasize really you know, it's not about where we are now, but sort of this idea of sort of a private governance initiative where it's really important that businesses rise to the occasion and foresee possible changes in the law as opposed to simply reacting, because that has simply not done any favors for the industry. And I guess one other thing is the Farm Bill of 2018, I know, has been something that a lot of people have had questions about. And because essentially it removes hemp from the Controlled Substances Act. And right now, a lot of companies have gotten in trouble for selling quote-unquote hemp products, quote-unquote CBD products, without actually having any CBD in the final finished product. So when you're, you know, talking to clients, it's really important to distinguish and determine exactly what they're selling and exactly what their goal is, because there are so many terms and a lot of different phrases used to describe the different marijuana and marijuana derived products. And that often creates a lot of confusion because, you know, essentially, if you don't have certification that you are selling a product that has 0.03% or less THC on a whole weight basis, then you're dealing with marijuana. You're no longer dealing with hemp. So, you know, that obviously implicates a lot of these legal issues I discussed. And also, you know, one thing that is pretty significant is as far as banking, right? So as someone who had difficulty getting a bank account myself, I certainly empathize, but you know, the minute you cover up or fail to disclose exactly what you're doing, you fall within the financial crime statute, and you are essentially structuring transactions. So that's why I always encourage individuals and businesses to just be forthright and explain what you're doing. And if you have connections at a bank or you have a good relationship with a local bank, you can find someone who will serve you, but it is never a good idea to lie about it or try to come up with an ambiguous name, because all I've seen is people have their bank accounts shut down. And, you know, that's obviously a nightmare and a headache to deal with. So as long as you're, you know, have, you know, transparency and full disclosure, that's really how you address, you know, the banking issue, you know, in my view and experience.
Yeah. I'm curious if you've had any kind of indication about how, I don't know if what the word might be, eager the federal government is to kind of enforce those types of laws in states where cannabis is legal. Are you seeing a lot of that? Or are you seeing maybe less of that?
So it's really, it's actually not the federal, you know, government so much, because the Financial Crimes and Enforcement Division essentially said, with respect to guidance for the industry, as long as you're filing suspicious activity reports for cash transactions or related transactions totaling $10,000, and you know, you are obviously monitoring for any other suspicious activity, there, I haven't seen any crackdown with respect to the violations of the Banking Secrecy Act and anti-money laundering laws. However, having spoken to many members of the State Cannabis Bankers Association, really, it's not worth it at the end of the day because of the risk that, you know, you could lose FDIC or NCUA insurance coverage. Obviously, there's an issue with the Federal Reserve Master Account access. And even though these issues have been, you know, addressed by courts, if you put yourself in the shoes of a bank, banking professionals are the most, probably other than lawyers, the most risk-averse professionals in any industry, right? Because, you know, you're dealing with the financial system. And so really, I think it's important to emphasize that their hands are tied at this point. And it's not so much that they fear, you know, actual enforcement, but it's not really worth it. If you think about a cost-benefit analysis, you know, you could be that one credit union or bank that does see a, you know, enforcement action, and then you're really in trouble. So I know that the bank in Maryland that deals with cannabis businesses, Severn Savings Bank, actually stopped accepting new applications for cannabis businesses, which they were charging $5,000 a month in account fees. So, you know, once you get to that level of demand, you're really in risky waters.
So, Emily, let's say that I'm a CPA who's interested in getting into the cannabis business, or at least serving folks who are in the cannabis business. What types of things should I be doing before just jumping in with both feet?
I would read every IRS tax court decision that has come out with respect. Yes, 280E is the absolute key. And I would also review the CHAMPS decision, which came out of California, which is the one case, which I previously mentioned, where the IRS tax court found that it was permissible to distinguish between marijuana and non-marijuana related businesses for purposes of application of 280E. And, you know, especially in this industry, I see time and time again, people rely on secondary sources and people do not look at the statute itself or do not look at the actual case or opinion. And maybe I'm just, you know, a nerd, but in my opinion, it's really worth it because there are so many rumors and misconceptions, and it's really key to go straight to the source and read it for yourself, and also to look for, I guess, objective and non-biased sources. So, you know, someone can summarize the IRS tax court decisions, but at the end of the day, it's your license on the line. It is your practice on the line. And if you really want to get into this industry, you need to go straight to the source, read it for yourself, understand it, and then feel comfortable moving forward with respect to advising clients in the industry.
So the logical very first step is just self-education.
Yes. And especially, you know, ask questions. So, you know, I'm obviously, if anybody, any listeners want to ask me anything or follow up, I'm always happy to talk with them. I often do get questions from CPAs and financial professionals because of the fact that there are so many different, you know, views and perspectives on these issues. And having, you know, written essentially the casebook on marijuana law and policy with my professor, these issues were something that I, you know, was very, you know, I got paid to research, right, these issues. And so I think having sort of an objective sounding board is also very important, just because I can't even count the number of times I've had someone, you know, say something or talk about, I guess, an experience or something someone else said about 280E or, you know, accounting in the industry. And it's a sense, simply like, you know, don't ask, don't tell, right? Mm-hmm. And I just, you know, that to me is the most dangerous, I guess, perspective to have on these issues. Because if you're doing it the right way, you have nothing, you know, to fear. But if you don't do it the right way, you risk aiding and abetting in addition to losing, you know, potentially losing your professional license, which is never good.
Right, exactly. So I have to ask before I let you go, with a name like Burns, are you a fan of marijuana puns or memes, or is it just kind of tired?
I love them.
Oh yeah,
I love them. In fact, I think that might be part of the reason I entered the industry. I think they are so funny. And if anybody wants, I guess, like the best speech with marijuana laden puns ever, they should check out Orrin Hatch's speech introducing the Meds Act 2018, and it is filled with marijuana puns, and I loved it.
any favorites, particular favorites of yours?
I don't know. Not off the top of my head.
That's fine. I just asked the question. But listen, some great advice there. Emily Burns, thank you so much for the insights and for joining me today. Hopefully we can continue this conversation as we see these issues advance a little further down the road. So thanks for being here.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me.
That was Emily Burns, an attorney and founder of Legally Burns LLC, which provides customized legal and consulting solutions specifically for the rapidly evolving cannabis industry. You can find out more by visiting legallyburns.com. If you want to read that pun-laced statement from Senator Orrin Hatch Emily talked about, just Google Orrin Hatch marijuana if you're like me and you like a good pun. And really, who doesn't? By the way, it's definitely worth 5 minutes of your time. Emily is also a thought leader for the Business Learning Institute. She has authored 3 original courses for the BLI. They are, 1, Cannabis Comes to Your State, Legal, Regulatory, and Compliance Considerations. The second one is A Cannabis Law Primer, CPA Accounting and Finance Edition. And finally, 3, Marijuanomics 101. I hope I'm saying that right. And really, who knows if I'm saying it right? I may be the first person to try to pronounce that. But Marijuanomics 101, The Economics of Legalization. Those are Emily's 3 courses for the BLI. You'll find details on those courses by visiting BLIonline.org/instructor/Emily-Burris. And speaking of the Business Learning Institute, this week's sponsor is the BLI. The BLI's Future Ready Learning Framework outlines the skills that CPAs need to thrive in the rapidly changing world of accounting and finance. That framework is all about gaining and maintaining deep technical knowledge along with a strategic skill set. And we're talking about strategic aptitudes that have been identified as most crucial for tomorrow's CPAs. Start mastering these future-ready skills now by visiting macpa.org/future-learning. That's all I got for you this week, gang. Have a great week. Talk to you again in, about 7 days.